Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Monday, May 7th. I'm Iqbal Ahmed.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. The current time is 5:06 and time for a full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Also today, News 101 reporters will be talking about Quebec student protests against proposed tuition hikes.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
Late last month, UBC sent a broadcast email to U.S. students informing them that interest rates on their government loans would double without congressional action. In the email, Jonathan McCauley, UBC Manager of Student Services and Policy, wrote, saying, quote, "The 2007 College Cost Reduction and Access Act, which capped interest rates of subsidizing U.S. loans at 3.4%, is set to expire on June 30th, 2012. The expiration of this act would raise interest rates back to the original 6.8% unless the U.S. Congress can pass a bill before July 1st, 2012 to extend the current interest rate by 1 year," end quote. Annie DeWolf, the Director of Student Financial Assistance and Awards, said the UBC wants to ensure American students were aware of the cost of repaying their student loans would increase because the cost of paying off the average student loan could increase by $1,000 if new legislation is not passed. DeWolf said around 450 UBC students, she said that around 450 UBC students receive loans subsidized by the U.S. government. She said UBC professors and disparities cost to $7 million per year in loans money from the U.S. Department of Education. According to the New York Times, the average student with Stanford loans graduates was close to $13,000 in debt. Last week, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives passed a bill that would take $5.9 from the 2010 Affordable Care Act, Obama's health care reform bill, to maintain the 3.4% interest rate. Democrats favor a plan to maintain the lower rate by closing tax loopholes for wealthy business owners. Obama said he will veto the proposed Republican bill.
Nobel Prize-winning environmental economist Mark Jackard was among the protesters with the advocacy group British Columbians for Climate Action, who were arrested and fined for blocking a coal train near the White Rock community's pier on Saturday night. Before the action, the Stop Coal campaigners made it known they were willing to be taken into custody to make their stand. RCMP arrived at the protest armed with a court injunction permitting them to arrest anyone who blocked the train, but allowed the demonstration to safely continue. Police even let protesters talk to media before politely arresting them, which happened without any resistance from the demonstrators. How nice. 12 men and one woman were taken to the White Rock RCMP detachment, where they were processed and served with a $155 fine for breaking the Railway Safety Act. Prior to the action, Mark Jackard, who is currently a professor at Simon Fraser University, said he was willing to be arrested to take a stand against using Canada's ports to export coal and not meet greenhouse gas reduction targets.
Those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for local weather forecasts as well as provincial and national headlines.
CITR 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine are proud to present In Medias Res. And Kelarissa. May 12th at the Waldorf Hotel. This is an early show and tickets will be available at the door. For more information, search for In Medias Res and Kelarissa, May 12th at the Waldorf on Facebook.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts downtown at
212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, The Kiss Store, Heart and Soul Clothing Inc., Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Scratch Records, Vinyl Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, welcome. And now we have our weather forecast for the week, brought to you by our resident weather lady, Claire Eagle.
Hi, listeners. We're really excited to bring you the weather, not from the UBC Storm Club, but from the Weather Network. So here is your five-day weather forecast for Monday, May 7th. For tonight, 11 degrees Celsius, partly cloudy, becoming cloudy overnight. For Tuesday, cloudy with a 30% chance of showers, high of 15. For Tuesday night, partly cloudy, windy, low 8. Wednesday, a mix of sun and cloud, high 14, low 8. Thursday, a mix of sun and cloud, high 14, low 8. You might get a mix up with Wednesday if you're not careful. Friday, sunny, low of 6, high of 17, except if you're inland, it'll be 21, so go inland. On Saturday, high 19, low 8, sunny as well. And Sunday, a mix of sun and cloud, high 20 and low 9. So overall, it looks like a fairly sunny weekend with a fair bit of sun because it'll be fairly sunny. And that's your weekday weather forecast brought to you by the Weather Network.
Thank you, Claire, for that weather update. And now it's time for your provincial and national headlines.
A report by Federal Aboriginal Affairs Minister John Duncan has stated that Ottawa needs to consider a flexible exit strategy from treaty negotiation debt for British Columbia First Nations. The report was prepared by the portfolio's BC Treaty Representative, James Lorney, and states that BC First Nations treaty negotiation debt now tops $420 million, which is unrealistic and an unsustainable barrier to reaching treaties. While the report does not advise discarding the treaty terms, it does suggest that Campbell River BC... that James Lorney, who was appointed Duncan's special BC Treaty Representative last year, it recommends that federal negotiators should seek more leeway to accept proposals at their local negotiating tables without seeking approval from Ottawa. Other recommendations address fisheries issues, Aboriginal revenue policies, and cost-sharing arrangements. In the past 20 years, BC has produced two treaties.
British Columbia officially apologized today for the Japanese-Canadian community for the internment of thousands of people during the Second World War. 70 years ago, 22,000 individuals were placed in internment camps across British Columbia as a supposed precautionary measure. The federal government apologized in 1988, but today was the first time that members of the provincial legislature formally apologized and acknowledged that Japanese Canadians were discriminated against simply because they were of Japanese descent. North Vancouver, Lonsdale, Liberal MLA Naomi Yamamoto, the first Canadian of Japanese descent elected to the BC legislature and the child of internment parents, introduced the apology, saying the internment of Japanese Canadians during the Second World War was unjust and contrary to British Columbia's core values.
And new legislation introduced by the provincial government has given the province's transit providers, TransLink, new power to go after fare evaders. Introduced by Transportation and Infrastructure Minister Blair Lextrom, these amendments to the South Coast British Columbia Transportation Authority Act will prevent fare evaders who don't pay fines from renewing their license and vehicle registration. Under the legislation, TransLink will have the authority to collect fines, set fine amounts, and resolve disputes. The revenue from the fines will go towards fine administration, dispute resolution services, and collection costs. These new regulations will come into effect this summer, so fare evaders, take care or just start paying your fare.
Next on your national news, we'll go to a story made by CITR reporter Martin Lemlin on the current protests and strife in Quebec over proposed tuition hikes.
It seems as though there's a slim possibility that Quebec student protests could finally be coming to an end. On Saturday, after an apparent marathon negotiation session, the provincial government and the various student unions have reached a tentative deal. But there's a hitch. None of the students have actually voted on or approved the deal yet. And there is a long list of student unions in Quebec. So throughout this week, we're expecting to learn just what the unions really think of Monsieur Charest and Quebec's Education Minister Lynn Beauchamp's latest deal. To find out just what's in this deal, we'll go to Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, a spokesman for CLAS.
It's a very complicated deal. First, the government decided to continue to increase tuition fees, but for the first semester, they decided to reduce the administrative fees of the universities at the same level of the increasing of tuition fees. So generally, the student bill won't go up next semester.
Ah, yes, the classic delay tactic. Give them what they want, but just for a little while. Basically, they want to hold off on the 75% tuition increase until December, then form a panel that'll look into making university spending more efficient and hopefully find ways to save on tuition that way. The problem is that there are no guarantees savings will be found, and from a healthy standpoint of political skepticism, that probably means they won't be found.
So basically what the government is asking us is to abandon our strike in the hands of a provisory committee on which we will be minoritary. So it's a deal that is already that is only provoking a lot of hesitation in the students' assemblies.
Hesitation is already beginning to manifest itself in outright rejection. There's no real structured timeline for when the student unions need to come to a decision. It's unnecessary, really. They're already pouring in. According to the CBC, 12 university and CEGEP groups have already voted down the deal, as opposed to one group who've adopted it. It seems at this point like this ongoing struggle is bound to continue. But we're not done picking this scab yet, so let's ask Monsieur Nadeau-Dubois for a bit of background on this thing.
Well, government is a very long strike. In fact, it is the biggest strike in Quebec history, which has a very big history of a student strike. We're talking about a strike of 13 weeks starting today. A strike who, at the biggest, was held by 300,000 Quebec post-secondary students. At the moment, we are at 170,000 people in strike in our province here. So it's really an historical mobilization, an unprecedented mobilization by the Quebec students on the specific issue of tuition.
And there lies the great divide. At $2,500 a year, Quebec pays the lowest tuition fees in the country. In fact, they pay about half of what the rest of the country pays. Even after the $1,650 increase, they'd still be doing well compared to the national average. But rising tuition costs have been a major bitch for years now. Some admire the students in Quebec for taking a stand before rates get out of control, while others politely suggest they fall in line like everyone else and take their licks. It is still fairly astounding to me that Quebec's student unions could pull out of their educational responsibilities and cause a striking stir that could actually make a difference. Although Rex Murphy tends to question whether this thing can even be considered a strike at all.
You cannot strike unless you hold something back that someone else wants. Typically, your labor. Students in Quebec are declining to receive a service many of them have already paid for.
Actually, many of their parents already paid for it. Which is really the basis for the authoritative side of the argument. That these narrow-minded kids think they can help themselves, their communities, the province, and the country by dismissing classes? Then, of course, there's the flip side of the argument. The side that satisfies our most deliciously rebellious instincts.
No, the rest of you are getting screwed. Like, you should think about what we're fighting for. And I think it's really important for North America, for Anglophone North America, to take this issue seriously.
I'm sure Jean Charest is absolutely steaming that he's been forced to take this thing seriously. In any other province in the country, this tuition hike would have passed through without any resistance at all. Maybe a protest march on a weekend or something. But the Quebecois are full of zest and zeal. The determination really is admirable. After the violence a couple weeks ago, Charest's government had their backs against the wall. They had to do something.
As I look at the whole series of events that we've witnessed over the last weeks and days, I think people will come to the conclusion that now is the time to bring this to an end and to return to classes.
So we tried to spread the increase over 7 years instead of five. And they got shot down.
In the discussions that we have with our members, people said that it was not enough to stop the strike because what our government offered us is not to lower the tuition hike, but to extend it on two more years. And we are concerned that this hike, we're talking about a 75% tuition hike on 7 years, is going to affect accessibility to post-secondary education.
Widely accessible post-secondary education is important to the Quebecois these days, mainly because they didn't always have it. In 1962, when Ontario was gaining recognition for its public education system, Quebec was still relying heavily on the Catholic Church to educate its people, a minority of them at that. In 1962, 54% of people under 25 in Quebec hadn't finished grade 6, and only 7% attended university. Way back when, even in Ontario, tuition averaged $500 a year. Students in Quebec might be whiny little brats with a false sense of entitlement, but they are stubbornly holding on to their ideals. They have a zero tolerance for tuition fee increases, and they're going to the mat with the man to get it. If they give in, this whole mess might be forgotten in a few short months, and they'll still have the lowest tuition in the country. But if they hold out and actually get what they want, well, it might just open the door for a slew of snotty little urchins to cry and moan until they get their way. And it'll probably close the door on Jean Charest's premiership as well.
And that was the provincial and national news here on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your international news right here on CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to News 101.
Have you heard of the newly opened NSCS Discovery Restaurant at 1515 Discovery in Jericho Park? Profits support NS Culinary Education Society of BC. Enjoy breakfast on the beach for only $4.95, served daily from 7 a.m. till 11 p.m. Say you heard this ad and receive 5% off lunch and dinner items until May 31st, 2012. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, or dinner at the newly opened NSCS Discovery Restaurant at 1515 Discovery in Jericho Park and support a local social enterprise.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM. We're online at citr.ca. And it is now time for your international news. So we go to Democracy Now!, where Amy Goodman interviews Yanis Varoufakis, a professor of economic theory at the University of Athens, to discuss the recent landmark victory of French presidential candidate François Hollande, as well as the Greek parliamentary elections, where voters have strongly supported far-left and far-right parties, including the surprising inclusion of Greek neo-Nazi party Golden Dawn into the Greek parliament for the first time in history. So this is Amy Goodman with Democracy Now!
DemocracyNow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In France's landmark presidential election, François Hollande has defeated incumbent Nicolas Sarkozy, making him the first socialist in 17 years to lead Europe's second biggest economy. Hollande soared to power on an anti-austerity platform in the midst of the euro crisis, demanding a European Union treaty limiting debt be expanded to include measures to produce economic growth. During his campaign, he proposed special taxes on banks and oil companies, as well as a 75% tax on those earning over €1 million, roughly 1.3 million U.S. dollars annually. Hollande's victory was narrow but uncontested. Official results showed him with 51.6% of the vote, while Sarkozy had just over 48%. He's the first socialist to win the French presidency since François Mitterrand in the 1980s. Hollande gave his victory speech in his stronghold of Toul in central France Sunday.
Je ne sais pas si vous m'entendez.
I don't know if you can hear me.
Mais moi, je vous ai entendu.
But I have heard you.
J'ai entendu votre volonté de changement.
I have heard your will for change. I have heard your strength, your hope, and I want to express to you all of my gratitude.
Je veux vous exprimer toute ma gratitude. Merci. Merci.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, people of France, gathered here to have allowed me to be your president of the republic.
As François Hollande headed to Paris, he addressed supporters at the Place de la Bastille, a traditional rallying point of the left. His jubilant supporters gathered to celebrate, drinking champagne, chanting, Sarko, it's over. This is Arnaud Montebourg, a member of France's Socialist Party.
I believe that he is laying the groundwork for more than just the alternative, with a lot of emotion. It is history. It hasn't happened for a socialist president for 24 years. It is possible, the French say it, to not accept the fatality of the financial markets, of deregulated finance, of unlimited globalization.
The newly elected Hollande also campaigned on a promise to pull France's troops from Afghanistan by the end of the year, 2 years ahead of the planned U.S. withdrawal. He's set to meet with NATO leaders at their summit in Chicago later this month, where the focus will be on Afghanistan. Meanwhile, incumbent Nicolas Sarkozy called Hollande to congratulate him on winning. Sarkozy accepted his defeat and urged supporters to accept the new leader of France.
Le peuple français a fait son
choix. Dear compatriots,
si vous me faites...
the French people have made their choice. If you trust me, I ask you to listen to what I have to tell you. I have thought about it a lot. France has a new president of the Republic. It is a democratic choice, Republican.
Meanwhile, in Greece, voters sent their own message against austerity Sunday during the country's parliamentary elections. The two main parties that had pledged to enact harsh international bailouts suffered significant losses at the polls. Voters rejected the governing parties in favor of far-left and far-right parties that have both opposed budget cuts. Left coalition leader Alexis Tsipras said he wanted to form a left-wing coalition rejecting the terms of Greece's bailouts.
We are sure that the Greek people will send a strong message to all of Europe for a change of course. There is no room for the barbaric bailout agreement in our European course.
Meanwhile, Greece's neo-Nazi Golden Dawn Party could enter parliament for the first time if their tally of almost 7% holds up. The party had pledged to, quote, clean up Greece by expelling all legal and illegal immigrants. The group, which openly displays books on Aryan supremacy at its party offices, has been frequently linked to racist attacks, but denies beating up migrants. For more on the changing face of Europe, we're joined now by Yanis Varoufakis. He is a professor of economic theory at the University of Athens in Greece. Yanis Varoufakis, welcome to Democracy Now. Let's begin in France, the significance of Hollande's victory.
It is a culmination of a cascade. Recall that 2 years ago, the euro crisis began, and it is the economy, stupid. In exactly the same way that you had a domino effect, toppling effectively states, beginning with Greece, then we went to Ireland. Those states became insolvent, went bankrupt. Then we moved to Portugal, then we moved to Spain, and we keep moving. We're moving to Italy, and at some point we'll come to France. At the same time, there was a cascade of collapses of governments. It began in Ireland, then we moved to Portugal. All those governments fell. Yesterday, we had another two governments that fell. One was the government of Mr. Sarkozy. France is going to be the battleground for the euro. And the failure of the eurozone to react rationally and efficiently to this crisis was the undoing of Mr. Sarkozy. What happened in Greece was not just a change of government. It was a political implosion, the implosion of a whole regime.
In terms of Hollande, tell us his story. How did he come to lead the Socialist Party and become the new president of France?
Hollande rose almost by default. The Socialists are a fragmented party. They're fractious. They've had a long history after their titular head, François Mitterrand, the only socialist ever to have been elected president, passed away. The socialists actually never got on with one another. And you will recall that in the last presidential election, the one that Mr. Sarkozy won, it was Ségolène Royal, who is the ex-partner of Mr. Hollande, that stood against Sarkozy. Mr. Hollande was not particularly loyal to her in that election. I think he actually undermined her. They have four children amongst themselves, but they couldn't actually get it together with that election. This time around, he didn't get much support from her or from the Socialist Party. It was the collapse of the legitimacy of the austerity policies of Mr. Sarkozy that effectively handed Mr. Hollande the presidency of the Republic. So this is not a pro-Hollande vote, it's an anti-Sarkozy vote.
At a mass rally in January, Hollande decried the world of finance as it currently functions.
Mon véritable adversaire. Il n'a pas de nom.
My real enemy doesn't have a name or a face or a party. He'll never run as president. And so he'll never be elected, although he does govern.
Il gouverne. Cet adversaire,
my enemy is the world of finance.
After winning a first place position in the first round presidential ballot, Hollande told journalists if he was elected, quote, there will be no more free trade and unlimited competition. What does that mean?
It means that there was a jostling for position between Sarkozy and Hollande, because if you read the speeches of Mr. Sarkozy, he was also waging supposedly war against the world of Anglo-American finance. French politics is replete with such rhetoric. In essence, I don't think there's going to be much of a difference. Mr. Hollande is, as of today, heavily constrained by the Central Bank of France, which is surely going to be onto him with words of caution about what the French president must do to retain the trust of the markets. And you will see a different Mr. Hollande. If you recall, François Mitterrand, the first president that came from the socialist camp, was elected in the early 80s on the basis of a almost Marxist platform. Within a year or so, he had become effectively a Thatcherite. I don't expect to see much of a difference from Hollande, but the significance of Hollande is that it's like a seed being planted in the foundations of the Eurozone, which hopefully will flourish, and the result will be an end to the idiocy which passes as economic policy in the Eurozone at the moment.
Professor Varoufakis, let's move to Greece. What happened?
Greece is going through its Great Depression, something akin to what the United States went through in the 1930s. This is not just a change of government. It's a social economy that has entered into a deep coma. It's a country that is effectively verging to the status of a failed state. Greece is going through an existentialist crisis. And just look at the numbers. The Socialist Party had 44% of the vote only two short years ago. They went down to 13%. The opposition conservatives, they were at a low tide mark of 35%, 35% in 2009. They would have been in opposition. They should be picking up votes. They went down below 20%. The political class of Greece effectively has been thrown out by the electorate. This is very exciting and very worrying at the same time. The rise of the Nazis is something to be lamented.
The Guardian reports today Greek TV channels are reporting the country's electoral earthquake has been met with stunned silence by officials at the International Monetary Fund in Washington.
It's their week of discontent because for the second time around, the International Monetary Fund has fomented, first time was in Latin America and perhaps Southeast Asia in the late 1990s. Now it's the second time their policies and their heavy-handed approach to a failing economy has created a spectacular failure in their own hands.
Meanwhile, Greek conservative leader Antonis Samaras said Sunday he's ready to try to form a national salvation government and appeal to pro-European parties to join him.
Είμαστε έτοιμοι. We
are ready to take the responsibility of the formation of the government of national salvation, with two specific aspirations, that the country remain in the euro, and the amendment of the policies of the bailout agreement so that there is growth and relief in Greek society. Today I submit this open proposal towards all the parties that accept the European course of the country and the need for a change of economic policy. I understand the rage of the people, but our party will not leave Greece ungoverned.
Frenzied attempt by the powers that be in Europe to convince Mr. Samaras, the leader of the Conservative Party, the leader of the Socialists, the fragmented and heavily defeated Socialists, and the leader of one of the small left-wing parties to forge a coalition in order to continue business as usual regarding the implementation of the austerity pact. Now, in other words, following the election, we are now going to be witnesses to a wholesale attempt by the European leadership in Brussels, in Frankfurt, in Berlin, to ensure that the popular will in Greece is subverted and that austerity continues, possibly dressed up by means of some nice anti-austerity rhetoric, when in reality the policies don't change.
You mentioned the Nazi Party in Greece, the rise of it, and also in France you have Marie Le Pen, although she didn't win, certainly rising in popularity.
The ultra-right does not need to win in order to gain power. The fact that they are rising in influence on the streets and in parliament is sufficient to inflict a major blow on democracy, to color the whole complexion of democracy. Let me give you a very simple example. Only 2 weeks ago, the Socialist Minister of Public Order introduced compulsory HIV tests on paperless migrant prostitutes, which were carried out by means of force, police brutality, and then their photographs were published in newspapers and on websites, official government websites. And all that was in order to demonstrate that you don't need to elect Nazis if you can elect me. When Nazis manage to influence the agenda in that way, they don't need to be in government.
The ultranationalist far-right Golden Dawn says it'll start by forcing immigrants out of Greece after exit polls show it would pass into parliament for the first time since the end of a military dictatorship in 1974.
What will be the first measure to change? Illegal immigration out of my country, out of my home.
So he wants legal and illegal immigrants, Golden Dawn.
He's a Nazi. He wants a Kristallnacht against anyone that doesn't look Greek, whatever that means.
Final comments on the significance of the elections in Greece and France.
It just goes to show that just like after 1929, when you start with a Wall Street collapse, which then spreads throughout the breadth and width of the world capitalist economies, similarly after 2008, we have an economic crisis that shook the foundations of the Eurozone. The Eurozone was never designed to sustain such a great financial crisis. And the Eurozone now is unraveling. The political class, just like in the 1930s, has failed spectacularly to mount a response to this economic crisis, and now there is a political implosion. Whether the fragmented opposition to the idiocy which passes as economic policy in Europe is going to find a common voice in order to stop the rot and put an end to the rise of the Nazis is something that we're going to have to wait and see.
Yanis Varoufakis, I want to thank you very much for being with us, professor of economic theory at the University of Athens in Greece. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
And thank you to Democracy Now! For that report on the situation in European politics right now.
Once again, we go to Democracy Now!, where, again, Amy Goodman discusses the student strikes against rising tuition rates in Quebec. And Evelyn Cotier, who is a researcher at IRIS, an Institute of Socioeconomic Research, and Gabriel de Dubois, a spokesperson for Class A, the main coalition of student unions involved in the student strikes in Quebec.
I'm Amy Goodman as we turn now to Canada, where students in the province of Quebec have reached a tentative deal with the government over proposed tuition hikes. The deal puts an end to nearly 3 months of a class boycott by hundreds of thousands of students and the longest student strike in the province's history. Students in Quebec pay the lowest post-secondary education tuition in Canada, and the provincial government's plan would raise tuition by 75% over 5 years. The agreement, reached after 22 hours of negotiations between student leaders and the government, includes the government's tuition increase, but also calls for the creation of a provisional council that would review spending by universities and could reduce fees students pay on top of their tuition. Under the tentative deal, universities would decrease administrative fees to offset the increase in tuition fees. Student leaders say they're refusing to recommend the deal to their membership. Students across Quebec will cast their vote on the agreement this week. During the May Day protests in New York last week, Democracy Now! Spoke to Lily Schwartzbaum, a student at McGill University in Montreal, about the strike.
It's really important for the states to look at Quebec as a model as to what people should be fighting for. Often people say of Quebec, oh, it's only like $16.25, like you should really pay your dues. And it's like, no, the rest of you are getting screwed. Like, you should think about what we're fighting for. And I think it's really important for North America, for Anglophone North America, to take this issue seriously.
To talk more about the student strikes and the agreement proposed this weekend, we go to Montreal, which has seen more than 200 student protests in the last 80 days. We're joined by Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, the spokesperson for CLASS, the main coalition of student unions involved in the Quebec student strikes, and by Democracy Now! Video stream, Evelyn Couturier is joining us from IRIS, which is an institute of socioeconomic research. We begin with Gabrielle. Tell us about this strike, the significance of it.
Well, it is a very long strike. In fact, it is the biggest strike in Quebec history, which has a very big history of student strike. We're talking about a strike of 13 weeks starting today. A strike at the biggest was held by 300,000 Quebec post-secondary students. At the moment, we are at 170,000 people in strike in our province here. So it's really an historical mobilization, an unprecedented mobilization by the Quebec students on the specific issue of tuition fees. The Liberal government here decided to increase the tuition fees by 75% starting next year and over 5 years. And the mobilization really started about this specific issue. But after a few weeks of strike, we have saw unions, community groups, women groups entering in the movement. And now what we are what we are seeing here in Quebec is what people call the maple spring, the printemps érable in French. So it's really a mobilization that is starting to be more and more general and to address more than the specific issue of tuition fees, but also the general direction that is taken in Quebec since the Liberal Party here came to power in 2003.
So for 3 months, students have not gone to school?
Well, it's not all the students of Quebec who are in strike, but a critical number of students are in strike. Yes, since now 3 months. It's even for Quebec, it's a non-precedented strike in terms of duration and in terms of popularity. So it's really a movement that no one really saw coming before it was a reality. So yeah, it's students from university and colleges all over the province who are in strike, so who are not going to their classes for 3 months now.
And with the significance of the deal that was reached this weekend?
Well, it's a very complicated deal. First, the government decided to continue to increase tuition fees, but for the first semester, they decided to reduce the administrative fees of the universities at the same level as the increasing of tuition fees. So generally, the student bill won't go up next semester. But what is particular in this offer is that the government accepted to put to fund a provisory committee of 19 persons, on which 4 will be students, and this committee will have the role to look at the expenses of our universities to find out money that could be be cut in order to invest this money in the reduction of the administrative fees of the universities. But so basically what the government is asking us is to abandon our strike in the hands of a provisory committee on which we will be minoritary. So it's a deal that is already that is already provoking a lot of hesitation in the students' assemblies.
Evelyne Couturier, can you talk about how college costs in Quebec compare with the rest of Canada and the United States and the significance of this strike?
Well, of course, in Quebec, the student fees are less high than in the rest of Canada. But then again, you have to compare with the whole picture, not only in North America, but in the whole developed countries. And then the students' fees in Quebec are much higher than the majority of the countries. So, and you also have to remember that when you talk about tuition fees, there's also a debt that is associated with that. So students who go to school have to pay a lot of things. It costs a lot. And the average debt in Quebec is also lower than in, let's say, Ontario. And hiking the fees, hiking the tuition, will mean to put the burden of the debt more and more on the shoulders of the students.
And the significance of this settlement, Evelyn, we just have 20 seconds.
I would say the burden of the proof is on the students, and that means a lot of things, because even though the students prove that there's a problem in the financing of the universities, the government will decide to implement or not the cuts to refund the universities.
Well, Evelyne Couturier, I want to thank you for being with us, and Gabrielle Nadeau-Dubois, spokesperson for CLASS, the main coalition of student unions involved in the student strikes in Quebec. We will report on what the students vote this week. That does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Fell, Sarah Monte, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sana Akhofani, Masu Grabi, Karen Dina, Desda, Chantal Berman.
Thank you to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! For that further insight into the Quebec student protests. We're now going to have a brief segment of Hardball with Iqbal, everyone's favorite section of News 101, discussing the current American political situation.
Thank you for the introduction, Claire. Now it's time for everyone's favorite segment, Hardball with Iqbal. And today I will be discussing the current state of the United States federal election between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. And this election
Don't forget
that...
Ron Paul.
And Ron Paul's in there. And I think who else is in there? No names.
Buddy Romer.
Yeah, Buddy Romer. Is he still a Republican nomination?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and it's Buddy Romer. But in all seriousness, it's down to Obama and Romney. It was a hard-fought primary election for Mitt Romney, and he's pretty stoked that he's gotten this far after bumps in the road like Newt Gingrich, came out of nowhere, fade into nothingness, you know, Santorum, and who was the other guy?
I hate when Santorum comes out of nowhere.
Herman Cain. Let's not forget about Herman Cain. Like, people thought he was going to win for a while, now see where he is. still running a pizza chain, I believe.
And coming up with the most ridiculous ads.
Yeah, the one with the guy smoking was my favorite.
Yeah. What about the girl who chopped off the head of a bunny and then...
What?
There's some ridiculous ones.
I wouldn't put it past him. Actually, Santorum had a really good one called Obamaville. Oh, and it was shot as like a horror movie.
Yes.
And so people having their guns taken away and taxes crippling ma and pa farmers.
Yeah, it was actually quite disturbing watching it. I thought someone was going to axe or something, but it was just sort of healthcare and things like that.
Gotta love American sensationalism. And so now the field has changed. And I think one of the interesting things to watch now will be how the Republican Party tries to fall in line behind someone who they have widely criticized for so many months. And so something they complained about so much, how they can convince the general public that those complaints weren't that big of a deal and now that you should vote for them. So in most U.S. federal elections, the idea is that the primary is responsible for kind of reestablishing your base of support within your own party and getting your party in line, getting all your ducks in order before the federal election. It is to choose who's going to run an election, but there's also a very practical voting engine to it and, like, mobilization.
The question is, do you think the Republican Party is in line?
Yeah, and that's what I'm about to get to, because Romney, he makes a lot of conservatives, both social and fiscal conservatives, very nervous. Social conservatives, you know, he's a Mormon at the end of the day, and a lot of social conservatism is based off of kind of hardline American evangelical beliefs, and although Mormons would think as well as, you know, Christians, to them they're something very far removed from that. And then fiscal conservatives can point to his record as governor of Massachusetts with his health care and tax and things like that. And so he makes both of the major pillars, social and fiscal conservatism of the Republican Party, very nervous. And then what people would come back and say, well, not going to vote for Obama. You know, like, if they had a choice between Romney and Obama, they're going to vote for Romney. But I would counter that with the thing that these people just won't vote. And such a big problem in the U.S. elections right now is that such little people vote. And you'd actually be surprised at how much every party, how many resources they put in, not into campaigning, but into getting their supporters to vote. To registering people to vote, to making sure on election that they actually get out and vote. Mm-hmm. That's like, they call it get out the vote campaign, and they just have like hundreds of volunteers and neighbors knocking on doors telling people to go vote. And they compile lists of their supporters in certain areas over the entire campaign. It's like, I've worked with the software before. It's called like Turf Builder and Vote Builder, and it kind of like, it allows you to see where all your support is on a map by like canvassing and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then your job on election day, or leading up to elections, to remind people to come vote for you. And that's where Romney comes into the problem, is that these people are, he's not going to invigorate these people. These people aren't going to be like, you know, jumping up and down, ready to vote for Romney. They'll maybe begrudgingly go there, but I think
that, vote for him out of spite?
Yeah, of Obama. And then at the same time, the biggest grassroots engine for the Republican Party has always, well, I guess since the times of Ronald Reagan's second term with the Christian Coalition, were churches, evangelical churches, the Christian right, mm-hmm. because churches are very good at organizing people. At the end of the day, it's a community people belong to. It's a very easy to access a lot of people through these big focal points. And that's why this kind of, the Christian right has played such an important role in American politics. And I'm saying I can't see many of the conservative churches, like in Florida, a very key state, in Pennsylvania, telling people to go out and vote for Romney due to social issues or the perceived threat they might have because he's a Mormon. But at the end of the day, it might be they're either voting for the Mormon or the Muslim. And that might get some of the evangelicals, you know, a bit more riled up.
Give them even more reason not to vote.
Yeah, exactly. Let's stay home and watch Bill O'Reilly instead.
I think we're going to have to wrap up Hardball with Iqbal to return our international news, but thank you for your insights as always, Iqbal.
Thank you, Claire, for the kind words, as always.
And it's now time for our FSRN international news. First of all, we go to our headlines for today.
FSRN headlines.
Some voters in Syria are going to the polls today, while according to the local coordinating committees, violence continues in cities across the country. Dozens of people were reportedly killed Saturday, at least another 20 on Sunday. Opposition groups are calling for electoral boycotts, saying the process is a sham. Louis Safi is a spokesperson for the Syrian National Committee.
How can you hold elections when half of the country is fighting and the military are bombarding towns and cities?
The vote is under new constitutional rules that allow multiple parties, the first in 40 years. But they can't be ethnically, religiously, or professionally centered. Oxford Syria expert Alan George explains the effect.
That automatically excludes the largest political forces in Syria, particularly the Muslim Brotherhood, which is likely to do well in any free and fair election, as indeed it did in Egypt. That alone eliminates the possibility of this election being genuine.
It's unclear how many people have died in the last 14 months of uprising. Estimates range from 9 to 14,000, with as many as 15,000 more missing. French President Nicolas Sarkozy was defeated yesterday by Socialist Party leader François Hollande. Khaled Sid Mohand reports from Paris.
Driven by the far-right wing of his party, Nicolas Sarkozy seems to have lost credibility with center-right voters, frightened by his anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim rhetoric. His 50-year-old challenger, François Hollande, has never held a government post at national level and is a man of consensus and moderation, in sharp contrast with Sarkozy's flashy personality. Throughout the campaign, Hollande has opposed an austerity-based financial policy and vows to open negotiations with the European Union, focusing on economic growth and job creation. On foreign policy, the president-elect said he will pull French troops out of Afghanistan by the end of the year and will only intervene in foreign countries under a United Nations mandate. Khaled Sid Mohand, Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
A court in Bahrain ordered that influential activist and blogger Nabil Rajab be detained for a week, pending a probe into his online activism. Rajab was arrested at the airport on Saturday as he returned from a human rights conference in Beirut. He's charged with inciting protests. Another prominent activist, Zainab Al-Khawaja, was in court yesterday. Her trial on charges of inciting hatred against the regime will continue later this week. Her father, Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, is nearing the 3-month mark of a hunger strike. He's serving a life sentence for his role in last year's pro-democracy uprising. And in Israeli prisons, as many as 2,500 Palestinians are on hunger strike. Ghassan Banura tells us that advocates say at least two are in critical condition.
Thaher Halahla and Bilal Diab are on their 70th day of hunger strike. An Israeli court rejected an appeal for their administrative detention today. And despite rumors of the contrary, the Palestinian Prisoner Society said today that both are still alive, but were admitted to a civilian hospital due to critical health conditions. Yesterday, Israeli authorities said 10 others were transferred for medical care. Last month, on Palestinian Prisoners' Day, hundreds more prisoners joined the hunger strike. It's unclear exactly how many are fasting. Estimates range from 1,500 to as many as 2,500. They want an end to ill treatment by their Israeli captors, as well as the halt of the administrative detention policy Israel uses against Palestinian political detainees. Ghassan Banura, Afasaran, Bethlehem.
According to a report by CNET, the FBI wants to force internet companies to write a surveillance feature into their program codes. In 1994, Congress passed the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act that required that communication systems have built-in surveillance tools. In 2004, the law was expanded to include broadband and voice over internet providers. Now the FBI wants to add the very programs that support online social networking, like Google Chat, Skype, and even Xbox. The agency is concerned about what they call going dark, or losing the ability to intercept communication as technology expands. The ballot for the upcoming U.S. presidential election is fleshing out. Libertarian delegates chose their presidential candidate this weekend. Former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson will join likely Republican candidate Mitt Romney and the Constitution Party's Virgil Good in challenging incumbent President Barack Obama in November. Johnson will be on the ballot in all 50 states, but whether he will be on the debate stage remains to be seen. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and the full newscast can be found on the website fsrn.org. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca.
And that was our program for today, which is Monday, May 7th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts, so thank you for all of our volunteers' hard work. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Iqbal Ahmed. Today's show was produced by CJ and Martin. For the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands.